Hi, and welcome to the Insight Podcast from British International Investment. This is the first podcast episode we've put out under our new name, having changed from CDC Group just earlier this week on the 4th of April. Although we may have a new name, this podcast series remains exactly the same. In it, we share some of the highlights from one of our recent Insight events, with the aim of sharing practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge, and research. So in today's episode, we look back at an event we held in March to mark International Women's Day. And on the panel, we have two experienced leaders in gender lens investing. Roshana Zafar is the visionary founder of Cash Foundation in Pakistan, which provides a range of financial services for women. And joining her, we have Hani Assad of Avanz Capital, a leading emerging markets investor and gender lens investing champion. And finally, chairing our panel is our host for today, Lindsay Taff, Director of Communications at British International Investment.
I'm delighted today actually to be joined by two stalwarts of inclusive investment and financing. Roshana Zafar is Managing Director and Founder of the Cash Foundation. Cash is one of our investees and one of the leading microfinance institutions in Pakistan. It promotes female entrepreneurship and has so far enabled more than 1 million low-income families across Pakistan to improve their standard of living. And we'll also be joined by Hani Assad, who is the founding partner at Avaaz Capital Partners, which is a global emerging markets private equity firm. Hani has had nearly 30 years experience in development finance, and it sounds like it was actually part of his journey at the IFC where he really started to see and leverage the opportunity that men have to advocate for gender smart investing. And it sounds like it was quite a painstaking process for him going around persuading team by team that it's important to have more women investors on their teams and that women entrepreneurs are a big market too for them. So as I mentioned in the intro, you've been in development finance for almost three decades and have seen the evolution of gender lens investment over that time. Could you tell us a bit about your own personal journey over that period?
So I'll start even a bit earlier. So first, I'm Egyptian Canadian and I grew up in Egypt. And I have to say that it was the influence of my mother, and she was a woman in who actually believed very much in that, let's say, parity between boys and girls when I was growing up and men and women. She instilled in us and all the family about in those values. And I think we grew up with that. So it was not something that I had to adopt or bring in. It was something that was natural to me. When I was at IFC, one of the big things we had to do in my early years was to increase the number of women in IFC staff overall. and to do so, I had basically in the early days, because now it's an integral part of IFC strategy for hiring, to have a more parity in terms of their hiring process. But before that, it was a bit of an effort. It's how to convince, as you mentioned earlier, Lindsay, how to convince teams that they should be bringing in more women. There was all the normal excuses, you all heard it. But I think the organization overcame that over the years when they realized that women were really outperforming. It was not a matter of, you know, it's a nice thing to do. It was actually a difference in performance.
So you can say. Was it quite male dominated when you joined IFC?
Oh, yes. It was a large percent. I think it was even in the 70% when I first joined, something of this nature. It's pretty, very high. I'm talking about the investment staff. It's not all staff, but investment staff. And then it obviously now it has shifted tremendously from that. I do not know the latest numbers. I left IFC about 10 years ago, so I'm not aware of the latest numbers, but it was something that it was a conscious effort that I did, realizing that I knew that at that time that performance of teams improves when you have a better balance. Whether we call it parity or balance, it's something else.
Thank you, Hani. I can see we've got Roshana. I'm hoping that you're in a better area. And can I come to you? Because obviously you do finance women directly. So I'd love to come back to you and talk to you again about the setup of Cache and what you've been achieving over the last 20 years.
Thank you so much, Lindsay, and I apologize for the connection. Can you hear me now? Okay, great. So I was just telling you that when I was a student looking at development economics, one of the things that struck me was the fact that women did have access to resources, and the opportunities were highly linked to that. So I worked with the World Bank, and during that period, I met a lot of women, and the narrative we would hear really would be the question of how to get the economic bandwidth in terms of influencing the choices within their families. So in this journey, I then met Dr. Eunice, who gave me the opportunity to really see how microfinance worked. And when I came back to Pakistan, my first challenge was really looking at the transaction, how to design a gender-sensitive program for women in Pakistan, given the culture and the environment that women entrepreneurs faced in the country. So the first thing was really looking at, when I conceived it, my idea was train the women and then give them the loans. But we realized that was really not the way forward. It was first give the loan, then add the training, and then build networks and provide opportunities. So the initial model, we really changed that, and we focused on designing the lending program, which was around the notion of solidarity lending. Because women tend to work better in groups. The issue that Hani was mentioning on risk-taking, from the perspective of the investor, that is also how women think when they take loans or they invest in businesses. So they would prefer to be in a cooperative setup. So the groups worked. But over the years, we've changed it. So I'll stop here after I mentioned the change. We realized that the groups were beginning to curtail women's enterprises, because every entrepreneur has their own journey, their own path. So over the past decade, we actually now work with the entrepreneur and the enterprise. And we've added specific trainings for the sectors that they work in. And we also added a lot of insurance products. So that's really how the whole framework works. Originally, we began with just the loan. Then we focused on the entrepreneur and the enterprise. And then we looked at the family in terms of what contingencies can hold the entrepreneur back, which were not planned. So that's when the insurance came in. And now we are looking for a pension savings product for long-term savings for women.
And how have you found the demand side going? I mean, you talk about this reticence on behalf of women to get involved, perhaps on their own. Was that an easy process, or has it been difficult to engage them?
So that's interesting, because a lot of times, and I'm going to be a little controversial here, a lot of times microfinance practitioners tend to be paternalistic, and the concepts are developed by men for women. And even sometimes we as women leaders tend to imbibe the same thinking processes. And we tend to think, we know better than the women. We, the women entrepreneurs, we can decide for them. We can have a cookie cutter approach, because scale matters to us. But it's very important to take stock and to listen to the entrepreneurs. And as I said, mark their journeys, listen to their narratives. And that's really what started happening 10 years into Kush. The women started coming to us and saying, but I need more money. I need less money. I need money for a longer tenure. I also need money for consumption smoothing. So I need money to invest in my home, because that's where my quality of life is. I need training on digital marketing. And so the move over really came from the women themselves, because there was a what we call now a group lending fatigue in the sector. And that's really what made us think that we need to treat the enterprise, the entrepreneur, individually.
So I'm going to broaden. Thank you, Roshana. I'm going to broaden the conversation out, and I'll introduce Hani back as well. But I'll stay with you, because we've got a great line with you. We've just started going from the micro impact of investing in women and started to draw into that macro impact. Could you talk a little bit more about why this focus on investing in women really matters with a broader macroeconomic perspective?
Lindsay, I think it's now, it's just, it's a no-brainer. Why would we not invest in women? Can I ask you that question in return? And we will then start thinking about this. I mean, 50% of the world's population is women. according to a Standards and Poor report, women's worth in terms of investable wealth is rising. So the issues that women care about are going to come in the forefront. Women in leadership are emerging all across the world. So really, why shouldn't we invest in women? And when we look at the issue of feminization of poverty, if there are 1.6 billion poor people in the world, 70% of them are women. So it's a question of equity. It's a question of human rights. It's a question of correcting the imbalance. It's a question of utilizing the opportunity that women represent.
I'd like to bring Hani in there from an investor perspective. What's your view on this macro context and making the case for investing with women?
So I'll take the other side of the view from Roshani's about the business case. So let's just start with the word innovation and the importance of innovation in economic development. That has been proven that innovation innovation in business today brings in productivity, brings in products and services that target specific needs of people. So as we've seen with the digitization of the economies, we're now able to provide specific services to one subgroup from far away or from, and that these services become more affordable, more accessible, et cetera. So we start with innovation. The importance of innovation is the first thing. The second thing is you can't innovate with just men. We know that. So the participation of men and women in innovation is very, very important. Now, we also know that women, and I'll be a little bit more controversial, and I can say that women are very creative and even more so than men on average. I'm talking about averages, not, you know, the exceptions here and there. But women, why are they more creative and able to innovate more? It's because they're a lot more collaborative. And innovation comes from collaboration. It's exchanging ideas and it's working out the ideas, and innovation is it's the conversation and the between multiple people that comes up with a better idea. No one has one good idea that's going to run all the way. We need that back and forth. So that collaborative approach makes women a lot more innovative than if you only have if you have men, for sure, they're not as much in innovation. So let's just look at that. Then you look at the next step, which is how do women work in teams? So teams become a lot more productive when there are more women in it. And there are studies, and I've been asked to give you some evidence. There's a McKinsey study that I've read that shows you that teams that have more women in them increase their productivity, I can tell you, 128%. That's a large number. It's 128% increase in productivity when there are more women in a team than no women, okay? So there are studies that show you that. So if you take that productivity and then you get that innovation together, then yes, women are an integral part of best practice in business today. So now let's look at the returns from an investment point of view. So as you well know, IFC has done a study in 2019, issued on the 8th of March, International Women's Day, that demonstrated that if you have more women in the fund management team, I think they said above the 30%, it's not as 50% yet, but let's say in 30% and above, you get a 20% increase in return. That's a large percent increase in return that is worth making that effort. So that's just on the return. But then in terms of why do you want more women in investment teams? So let's just look at that, because I focus on that a great deal. It's because women can figure out how to invest with women-led organizations or companies that invest in products and services that are particularly suited for women. And that ability to see a woman being presented to a fund manager and being able to assess that ability is something that men sometimes don't do very well. So in terms of, you know, I go back to the decision-making, who makes decisions across the world in any kind of expenditure? Is it only men? Is it only women? No, it's a combination of both. So if we forego 50% of the decision makers, and I think it's even 70%, women make 70% of the purchases, then you'd see that it changes the dynamics a great deal when we don't know how to make that assessment of good businesses that women lead.
Yeah, and I think I'm picking up something from what Roshana has said, and actually what you've said as well, is that, gender lens investing in women is still sometimes seen as a niche, and it really shouldn't do, because we don't think about segmentation in that sort of niche way in any other part of business. So what do you think we need to do to start making this sort of adoption of more inclusive investment policies and practices more mainstream?
So I was looking at some statistics, and I gave that statistics earlier yesterday at another talk. So there is about 69 trillion assets under management around the world today. Study showed that 69 trillion, 98.7% decision makers are men. So obviously they missed the point. 98.7% of decision makers of how to allocate this money are men. So that's the first thing. So need to change at the investor level. So the investors themselves need to be more diverse in thinking. Number two is the fund managers, who are actually now allocators to companies, need to be changed as well. And we say it's not 50-50 again. Get to 20%, get to 23%, then you start making the change. So it's how we look at investment decision making that's going to bring to that that changes. So in my view, there are very simple things to do. I tell investors, just ask the question. Ask the question, why are no women in your team, in your fund management team? If you ask that question, then they start thinking about it and they say, I need to answer that question. And if I need to answer that question, I need to have a reason why there are no women in my team. And I have to start thinking about the next time I hire another person, right? If you get all investors to start saying that, and by the way, this is why there's a due diligence questionnaire now with this question in there, right? So that investors start asking those questions, that's going to be a major change in how we do business. Because once you ask it, there must be an answer.
And Roshana, when you're talking to your peers, obviously you're approaching your business from a women-centric perspective. Arguments or processes do you put forward to your peers to sort of break down some of those barriers?
I think, Lindsay, again, a very good question, because women have to work harder to prove themselves in whatever field they are. And they have to work twice as much as men at times. And I see that in my organization. I mean, I think some of the points that Hani made before I come to the main question that you asked, in terms of how do we break the myths around women's investments and how do you convince other people around you? Even within my organization, 50% of the staff are women, 70% of my board are women. So we've been very, very conscious in ensuring that women voices are heard and that they are part of the policies that we make. I often say that a lot of times the HR policies that we have, they've been made by men for men. And now what COVID did, I mean, the silver lining around COVID was that it forced us to rethink about flexibility in a lot of the work from home options and so on and so forth, which suit women more. So similarly, when it comes to convincing peers that women are good investing, I think the numbers speak for themselves. As I said to you, we, despite COVID, despite the fact that women's businesses were much more affected by COVID, because they worked in businesses that had that were linked to closures and lockdowns, for example, beauty salons or schools or what have you. So they were much more affected from COVID. And we do know from data that's come to the bank that the poverty incidence amongst females is going to increase post-COVID much more than it has amongst men. So keeping that as a purview, post-COVID, women have performed better despite the challenges they face. And one of the things we do need to do is to document this and show that this works. So I think one of the parameters should be to see if you're a for-profit organization, how does women's participation at the board, at the level of the employees, and at the level of the clientele, what returns does that give you with or without? If we read the McKinsey report that Hani mentioned, we'll all be better off if women are part of the economy. That's what the bottom line of that report is. GDP growth is going to increase. Now, I'm not a proponent of saying that we only look at GDP growth to measure change. We also need to look at all the other factors that I had mentioned earlier, which is decision-making, health, education, investment in the children, investment in quality of life, and so on and so forth. Those are equally important parameters to convince peers regarding the business case for women.
And are there ways that you can see that we can more effectively build this conversation to address the needs and gaps that women have? Because I think the case is there, but we've not yet entirely bridged that gap. Is it more innovation? Is it different? You talked about different types of financing that are needed. Roshana, where do you see the sort of next front on the battlefield is on this?
I think the first thing is level playing field, Lindsay. That factor has to be there. As I said, I'm not a proponent for affirmative action. Yes, it's needed sometimes to create that level playing field for women, startups and tech, whatever sector you're looking at. Data does tell us that women-led enterprises tend to be underfunded. That's the general perception because the risk is seen to be higher. So we have to overcome this, like I said, through data, through a better business case. I also see, I give an example sometimes. When you have a man and a woman applying for the same position and you look at their CVs, the man's CV will always oversell and the woman's CV will always undersell. I don't know if it's true for other cultures, but it is true for Pakistan. So often I look at the CV and I say to myself, okay, I'm going to cut the man, I'm going to give the woman flack, and I'm going to cut down the man in terms of assessing. And the same goes for when the woman is interviewing. She will be very diffident. She will be very, she'll just run herself down to a large extent. The same goes for women investors. When I was trying to raise money from different investors, I'm talking now 15 years ago, 20 years ago, this was the early times. It was very hard. Like you said, men tend to have the old boys club. So they can go for golf with the banker and get the loan. It was very difficult for me to be able to open the door for myself because the culture didn't allow it. I couldn't go out and to play golf with the banker and get my loan done because that's how a lot of deals were being done in those times. And I'm sure that's true now also. But what I'm sharing with you are the barriers that women face, which are not overt. Usually underlying the way, and so that cuts, the networking is not there, the association is not there, sometimes the data is not there, and sometimes your own inability to express the value of your business is not there either. So all of these things compound, though things are changing now. I see the space changing. The younger entrepreneurs that are now coming up, they're much more with it, and they're much more able to express themselves. But yes, you're right, we still have a long way to go.
So thank you very much for listening to this podcast from British International Investment. If you want to watch the full recording of this event, you can find a link to it in the episode notes. That's about it from us today. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back again with a new podcast episode very soon.